This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Matt, you said it before, but I just want to hear you say it again after I've seen this terrific third installment, which may be the best one yet, that you're not going to be playing Jason Bourne ever again.
Well,
and secondly, what did you learn from 3 years of playing this coldly efficient amnesiac killer?
Starting with the easy one, huh, Stephen? All right. Well, I said I made that comment at Cannes when we were about 9 months into shooting the movie, and I just went, "I'm never doing this again." But I think, you know, in terms of another one, the story of this guy's search for his identity is over because he's got all the answers. So there's no way we could kind of trot out the same character, and so much of what makes him interesting is that internal struggle that was happening for him. And, you know, am I a good guy? Am I a bad guy? You know, what is the secret behind my identity? What am I blocking out? Why am I remembering these images, these disturbing images? So all of that internal kind of propulsive mechanism, right, that drives the character is not there. So if there was to be another one, then it would have to be a complete reconfiguration. You know, where do you go from there? For me, I kind of feel like the story that we set out to tell has now been told. I love the character, and I love if Paul Greengrass calls me in 10 years and says, "Now we can do it because it's been 10 years and I have a way to bring him back." You know, then there's a world in which I could go, "Well, yeah, absolutely." I mean, we could get the band back together, and if there was a great idea behind it. But in terms of now in this story, that part is it's the story's been told. I mean, there's not really any. If we came out with a fourth one and suddenly, I got bonked on the head, and I mean, you guys would be like, "Are you kidding me? This is just, I was talking to someone yesterday, a journalist yesterday, who suggested that we could do the fourth one about Bourne losing his keys. The entire movie. Where are my keys? And that kind of illustrates, how kind of out of story we are at this point, in terms of what was good about, these first three. So, and in terms of playing it, the character, I mean, it was, it's been 7 years, really, for me. I mean, the movies have come out over the course of five, but it's been 7 years of my life kind of coming back to the, and it's been the great, I mean, there hasn't been a role that's had a bigger impact on my life. Maybe Good Will Hunting did, because it pulled Ben and I out of total obscurity. But in terms of having an impact on my career, I mean, just as an example, between Supremacy and this one, Bourne Ultimatum, there were three movies that I really wanted to do. This, I loved the scripts to three movies in particular. All of these movies were, on the face of them, going to be absolute box office, misses. And they were Syriana, which was a very complicated movie, and we were making, George and I cut all our money so we could do it. And The Departed, which now looking back obviously it was this big hit, but it won all the awards. But at the time, if you took a Scorsese movie, you know his movies classically don't make a lot of money. Even the masterpieces, Goodfellas, I mean, Raging Bull, they don't actually make a lot of money at the box office. It's this incredible experience because you're working with him, and which is why he can get any actor he wants. Well, everyone will cut their fee and go and work with Marty. But in terms of looking at your career, you go, well, okay, so that's number two, and that's that'll be two movies in a row that I'm in that don't perform at the box office. And then I fell in love with a script called The Good Shepherd, and everyone went, look, this is a tiny little bullseye you're aiming at here. And you look at it and you go, it's a very dense, cerebral, historical epic about the birth of the intelligence service in America. I mean, it's not Spider-Man 3. So, but I didn't hesitate because I loved all the scripts, and they were movies that I desperately wanted to do, and I knew that I had the Bourne Ultimatum off in the middle distance, and that there was going to be an audience that was built in for that. So it really just allowed me the kind of creative freedom to make all these movies, which each individually, I'm just so happy, I'm proud of each of those movies. They all did very well, some of them did incredibly well, and they were all reviewed really well, so they all just made a big impact on my career. So So that's just like another, that's in like an ancillary way that, that the Bourne character has completely changed my life. I mean, and starting with the first one, where nobody had offered me a movie in 6 months, and I was in London doing a play in the West End, and the movie opened, and by that Monday, I had 20 offers, you know. So that was where I was, you know, I was 30, I would have been 32 years old or 31 years old. It was like the rose-colored lenses came off. I went, okay, I get it. It's, you know.
If you're in a hit,
if you're in a hit, you get, yeah, you have a career. And if you're not, it doesn't matter how, if they, they might think you're a real nice guy. They're not hanging a movie on you, you know.
Matt, I don't know if you've had a chance to see these movies with an audience, but people cheer when you're kicking ass and crashing cars. How does it feel to be that kind of a crowd pleaser?
It feels so good, I can't even tell you. In fact, you guys were the second audience to see the movie, so none of us have seen it with an audience. So 2 nights ago, when the first press screening happened, we were all getting blackberried during the movie. You know, they're cheering at Waterloo. They're cheering, you know, and this was because nobody had. We didn't know. We came so down to the wire, as we always do on these porn movies, that we didn't even get a test in. So we had shown it to, you know. We each had little DVDs. We showed it on televisions. I showed it to my wife. I showed it to my brother. He was like, "Yeah, cool," you know. But those and so we'd have these little friends and family screenings. You know, Paul showed it to, you know, 25 people. You know, people in the business that we know that make movies. And, you know, are we missing anything, guys? Can you know help us out? And, you know, collecting notes as quickly as we could and trying to get them into the edit and then putting it out. So two audiences have seen the movie, of which you guys are the second. So to hear that you know, last night we were at dinner and, you know, we got Amanda, you know, we got the blackberries all started going off at the same time, and we heard that there, you know, that it was a crowd pleaser again. And so that was, you know, it was Paul and George Nolfi, the writer, and me and Joan and David Strathairn and Julia. And so we just told Amanda to expect a hungover group coming in the next day, because that's when the champagne started, the champagne came out. So.
Hey, Matt, two-parter for you. First of all, with its rather chilling comments on government intrusiveness, is this film more timely now than the first one? And secondly, I understand that you and your better half are writing another script together. How's that going, and what can you talk about your relationship with what's his name?
Well, all the movies, I think, are very much of the time that they, you know, the first one is very much a 2002. It's a post 9/11. You know, all of the feeling, all the paranoia, everything in there. What I love about them is that they're, you'll be able to look back and know the second one is 2004. You know, things are starting to turn in Iraq and. And now this kind of American guy, is this iconic American figure, is going and apologizing and atoning for his misdeeds, for things that he's done. He's taking responsibility. Now you have the movie ending where, you know, Bourne is pulling the gun and putting it to the head of the person who lied to him, who said, "This is what you're going to be doing. This is the you're going to be saving American lives." And Bourne saying, "I see now that you've let me into something under false pretenses, and now I understand that, and I'm not going to do that anymore." And so each movie is very much, I think, a reflection of, the time which it's made. I mean, we obviously have all the, you know, the images of waterboarding, of somebody getting shot in the corner of the room who Bourne doesn't even know what he did. He asks, "What did he do?" And, you know, and he's told that we've been through that. You can't know that. So, you know, this is somebody who's an American who's killed without a trial. And so all of these things are just little kind of nods to the world that we're living in right now. And I like that about them. They feel like they feel relevant. They feel, you know, Bourne has a lot of integrity. I do think he's a very kind of American, character. I like that about him. His thoughtfulness, his intelligence, the fact that he's trying to do the right thing. It doesn't always do the right thing, or is misled, but is trying to do the right thing. So those things I think are great. In terms of my hetero life mate, as Kevin Smith once said in one of his movies, We are not working on a script right now, but we're talking about a bunch of different things. And I mean, his career just totally has gone in this really new and exciting direction, because I've seen the movie that he directed, and it is really good. It's fantastic, and the performances are great. And every actor is going to want to work with him after they see this thing. And it's coming out in October, and it's done. I mean, he's finished, so they're just waiting for the proper release date to bring it out, which I think is somewhere. I think they're doing it around the time The Departed came out. I think that's when it's coming out. So you know, he's gone from being an actor to now being a director, now being somebody that can give me a job. So our whole relationship's completely changed.
So you'll be directed by him soon.
I would love to. That's a new dynamic that our partnership can have. Right, we can do a movie that we act in, or I act in, and he directs, or something that we co-direct, or something that we co-write and co-direct. You know, there's so many different possibilities now because he's gone and done this really great movie. So it's exciting, and we're, now we've started to talk about that stuff again. It's been 10 years since the last one, and we both put our heads down and worked pretty hard in this last 10 years, and so now we've woken up with, careers and families and all of the things that we wanted, and so I think hopefully the next 10 years will be about doing better work, maybe doing a little less of it, but doing better stuff and doing more together.
Two-part question. One, I wanted to find out what your favorite action sequence was to make in this one. And secondly, was there a sequence in Washington outdoors at the mall that you shot but it didn't quite make it in, or what happened with that?
Yeah, I'll do the second part first. Joni and I have shot over the course of the last two movies, probably, we were talking about it, laughing about it at dinner last night, probably 8 scenes Joan Allen and I have shot. Probably 3 or 4 in Supremacy, and 3 or 4 in this one, where, it's a weird thing. We make these movies are changing. It's such a fluid. It's a really weird process, and we'll end up doing scenes, and we'll just be sitting there shooting it, going, "Well, this is never going to be in the movie. This doesn't work at all." But a lot of that we don't know until we get them up on their feet, and so as a result, Joan and I have done a number of scenes together, all of which are on, I mean, you could make a DVD of, we've done the same scene in all these different locations, and finally what we ended up with is that little quick scene outside the hospital in New York where I give her the thing. So that was, it's kind of a good indicator. It's kind of the way, like, the amount of attrition, like the attrition rate, like, we shoot, our ratio of, like, scenes shot to scenes that make the movie are probably like that, about 8 to 1. So it's a really, I mean, that's what happens when you start without a script,
Okay. And the favorite action sequence that did make it into a script?
Well, I always liked the Tangier sequence, because, and the running along the roof, and the, because it's just born absolutely, 100 miles an hour flat out. And I always liked then grabbing the things and wrapping, like all the things that we kind of came up with when we were on the real location. That's the fun stuff, because you get like a bunch of guys together and are going like, all right, well, what would be the smart thing to do here? And we kind of figure out those sequences, and when we cut them together and they actually work, it's really a good feeling. Although Paul came up with Waterloo. That was all Paul's kind of design, and what would it be like to have a guy leading a complete novice through, to try to elude the and that was all Paul, and I love that sequence too, and the car chase too.
Hi, Matt. One of the things about this movie franchise that's so exciting is the intelligence of it all. When you first start out, you're more of a robotic character, and as we deconstruct you and you see the emotion, as we find our way back to David Webb, did you have to deal with any part of the backstory of David Webb? And number two, will you do any more narration work since you have such a great voice?
Right, thank you. What'd you say? we always kind of had a feeling about kind of where the Bourne character came from, that he would have been trained, that he would have had a military background. Presumably he was tapped from, one of these programs, and as a good candidate, and showed language skills, we had a kind of an idea of what that a loose idea of what that backstory was. We didn't want to pin anything too far down because obviously making all three movies, we never really knew. But we definitely knew enough that I could do all the physical stuff and get ready so that the character was kind of hopefully believable. In terms of narration, I'm going to narrate a movie called Running the Sahara, which we produced. It's about these three ultramarathoners. It's a documentary. They ran across the Sahara Desert last year, about 50 miles every day. Three guys from three different countries, and they and it's a movie about that expedition and also what happened to them on the run and how they became aware of a lot of issues, particularly the water crisis in Africa. And so that's going to be at the Toronto Film Festival this year.
Hey Matt, how you doing?
Good.
Now, did you get hurt at all doing any of the stuff, maybe that fighting scene? And secondly, what's your update on fatherhood? We caught you last time; you were just had a little teeny baby. What's going on now?
The fighting stuff. Yeah, the first movie I was 29, and this last one I was 36, and I definitely felt my age. And particularly because that big fight scene in Tangier, Joey, the other actor, the guy that I'm fighting, is like 23 years old, and the first movie came out, and he was in high school, and so he was so happy to. He was like, "Mate, I'm in a Bourne fight. This is great," you know. And he's in really good shape, and he's already like a much better athlete than me. So I was like, "Oh man, Joey, you're killing me. You got to slow down." And so I think it took probably a couple extra days. You know, it probably cost the studio a couple extra days because I'm a little older now. But
did he really go for you?
No, I mean, he just was so excited, and so, I mean, I couldn't possibly defend myself against him, so he'd be like, "Dude, just like three moves at a time, come on, man." So he was a good sport about it, though. He did a great job.
And being a dad?
Being a dad is still great. It's just amazing. I mean, these stages just go by at such a, I mean, it's like, It's incredibly fast, you know. I mean, the little discoveries every day. So much is happening, and so much changes, you know, in the first year. That, I mean, she's walking around now. It's, you know, she's 13 months old. So it's like just this. It's just amazing. It happens at warp speed. I see why people, when parents see little babies, they get that thing. They go, "Oh, I want another one," because the stages all just fly past. And if you're with her every day, which I'm lucky enough to be, you know, it's only if you're taking pictures, or it's only if people you haven't seen people for a couple months that you even realize, because it's happening in front of you. You know, you don't even see it.
Does anything confound you about it? Like you just can't figure it out still?
I try to figure out what it is. I mean, right now she kind of sounds like a crow. She kind of goes like like that, and points at things. And this morning, like, she pointed at the ceiling, and there was nothing on the ceiling. And she just went, "Ah!" like that. And I was like, "Well, that's the ceiling." And she went, "Ah!" And I was like, "No, I don't know what's funny about that. I don't. So I'm trying to figure out what's going on in her head. Like, sometimes you know. Sometimes she goes, "Ah!" And you go, "Oh, you know, you want some milk?" And she goes, "Ah!" You know, and you go, "All right, she was thirsty. That's good. She communicated." But then sometimes she just has these things that I just have no idea what she's thinking, so I'm working on that.
Next question.
Matt, you talked about coming to this film without a script, and, you know, considering what Paul does in his non-Hollywood blockbuster films, his improv, documentary-style things, does that make it easier, and what kind of sort of relationship do you have with him sort of, shaping the film as it goes along?
Yeah, he's the guy that I'd do that with. I mean, he's so great at that, and he's also a terrific writer. You know, I mean, he wrote United 93, he wrote Bloody Sunday. You know, he's a really good writer, and he does a significant amount of the work on these movies too, which any director does. I mean, you have to take ownership. You're telling a story, even if someone else has written it, you have to tell the story in a way that makes sense for you. So every director worth his salt is a pretty good writer too. You know, they never take credit for it. I mean, that's, you know, unless it's just them doing it, but, you know, generally that's what, you know, what the writer's there for. And we were lucky enough to have George Nolfi on set with us every day. So George kept out ahead of us. He would literally be in his hotel room working on the pages for the next day while we were working on the pages he'd given us for this day, and we were making our tweaks and in the real location going, okay, well, let's change this to that because that thing's over there. And so it's just this, it's, you know, it's not an advisable way to make a movie. Like, you couldn't teach that in film school and send people out there. But it works for Paul, and there's something about the chaos of and the alchemy of, like, Frank Marshall and Paul Greengrass and, you know, in this case, we had three different guys, you know, working on the script, Tony Gilroy, Scott Burns, and George Nolfi, who were, you know, at different stages and who are three of the best writers working today. And so it's like you get these, you know, this big mix, and then you get the actors in there, and I mean, but they've all gone down to the 11th hour. We literally haven't known until, you know, two nights ago. So it's I mean, you know, it should come with a stint, you know. It's like a it's not an advisable way to work if you want to live a long life.
Last question.
The Bourne brand has been very successful. Would you consider doing another role, whether four, five, or six movies that the character could appear in? And second of all, you're at a point in your career now where you can do anything you want, I'm pretty sure. So what do you want to be known for at the end of the day?
So would I with the Bourne character, would I do three more Bourne movies, do you mean? I'm trying to only do franchises. That's my new thing. That's my new thing. Yeah. In fact, when the guys who wrote Ocean's 13 wrote the movie Rounders, and I said to them, because Rounders was a bomb when it came out, but now it's done really well on video, and I said, you guys are writing the wrong sequel. We should be doing Rounders too. So, no, I'm open to, you know, in each case of the, you know, with both Bourne, and I know that Ludlum had written three books, but I signed up for one, and they were okay with that. And then when I signed up for the second one, I didn't sign up for the third. I only signed up for one again because I wanted to, you know, make sure that it went well, and I still like doing it. And so I've done it, and the Ocean's movies have just, you know, Stephen calls and goes, we're doing another one, and I go, okay, I'm in. And you know, so, but there was never kind of an eye to being, for me, for either of them being franchises. I don't think that way. And so I'm open to any, you know, any good movie. If I enjoy the experience and I love the people I'm working with and I feel like there's a chance to make a good movie, I'll make it if it's a sequel or if it's not.
And so
the other question.
At the end of the day, what do you want to be known?
Well, you know, the career that I think Ben and I, you know, look at. I mean, well, Clooney's definitely doing it right now, and Clint Eastwood. Those are the careers where, you know, guys are acting, they're writing, they're directing, and they're doing it on their terms. I mean, I think that's the biggest. I love making movies, and I love everything about it, and I love writing, and I love acting, and I really want to direct, and I've been taking this last 10 years to really carefully study these directors that I've been working with, and I worked with a lot of really good ones at this point, and so I feel like I'm ready to do it, and that to me would be the great, you know, to have a long career. I mean, it's so hard to have a long career in this business. It's, I mean, you guys see people just, I mean, I'm still here after 10 years, and we're all probably a little amazed by that. But yeah, so at this point, I just want to try and keep, you know, just be smart about the work that I'm doing and try to have integrity about the choices I make, and that's it.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
What are you doing next, Matt?
Well, I'm hoping to do this Green Zone movie that Paul's doing, but I don't know. I'm doing The Informant with Steven Soderbergh that we've been trying to do for years, starting April 15th, because we have the strike coming. So
he's trying to get everything done before.
He's trying to get everything done before, and so Steven knew that I wanted to do Paul's movie, so he moved all the way up. So he'd basically go from April 15th to June 30th, and the strike starts the next day. So if Paul can get me in before April 15th, on the Green Zone movie, then I can do it.
So the strike's definitely happening then.
Well, if not, apparently, from what I hear, it's going to be a de facto strike. Like, the studios are doing all of their whole production slate, they're doing in the first half of the year.
On the assumption that
there is a strike. It also gives them leverage, you know, against the unions, because then they say, like, well, we don't need movies anyway. We'll just take the next 6 months off.
No,
and, so you're not
and how much was you really? And I mean, this is such a physical movie. How much was it?
What's that?
The Aronofsky boxing film.
Yeah, the full script isn't in yet, so it's just it's another thing that's kind of out there.
Who else would you like to work with?
Thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate it.